from Charles Ferguson of The Guardian, because he did such a good job of this concise summary, selling defective mortgage securities during the housing bubble, creating and selling securities to bet on their failure, bringing the world to the brink of collapse, colluding to manipulate interest rates, hyping your failing company while secretly selling your own stock, cooking the books and assisting Bernie Madoff. But the scandals go on. Those are the scandals of the past. The scandals have continued. We have the LIBOR scandal, J.P. Morgan Chase's $9 billion London whale, money laundering for terrorists, tax cheats and drug traffickers. Wells Fargo discriminated against minorities and pushed them into subprime loans. Credit cards are now paying fines because of the add-on services that they pushed. And hedge funds are looting customer segregated accounts.
You know, we had taken a look in a previous show at the Dodd-Frank legislation and the proposed Volcker rule. Thereunder, we talked to people from Occupy SEC, and what we thought we needed to do today was to back up a little bit and come out of the weeds a bit and talk more generally about regulation of the financial services sector. As Liz noted, this litany of endemic fraud and seeming culture of impunity on the part of our financial services sector, CEOs, boards, officers, a willingness to commit fraud in this sort of endemic way. What do we need to be thinking about in terms of the way we regulate the financial services sector?
We'll be talking with Professor Bill Black in the second part of our show. He's a noted white-collar criminologist, a former federal regulator, author of the 2005 book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, and associate professor of law and economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So do you want to start with LIBOR and kind of talk about...
Yeah, the LIBOR is the London Interbank Overnight Rate, and that is the rate of interest that is charged by banks to borrow money from other banks. And what was revealed was that Barclays had engaged in a manipulation of the setting of the rates. Their brokers would call up the rate setters at the desk and tell them where to set the rate based on positions they had taken in the derivatives market. Additional revelations were that the New York Federal Reserve Bank was given insight into that as early as 2008 and took no action here. But again, it's one more example of what has become pandemic fraud in the systems that we have. You mentioned the mortgage securitization financial fraud, which has put us in the middle of this financial crisis we're in right now. As Professor Black will talk about later, this seems to be kind of a perfectly integrated vertical fraud. It involved the mortgage underwriters. It involved the ratings firms. It involved the investment banks. There was one fraud perpetrated on top of another, seemingly out of sight of the regulatory framework that existed to prevent that kind of fraud.
We spent last night reading Reinventing Crony Capitalism, the context of Geithner's obscene rant against Borofsky. That's Dr. Black's 15-page article. And it goes into the history of what we're seeing now, where the precedents were set.
It's a bigger discussion, I think, about what's the role of our financial regulators. One party has a view that any regulation is bad regulation. It prevents innovation. It prevents the job seekers from making the economy clip along, versus those that are called kind of reformers, people that want to engage in kind of a relationship with business that's less prescriptive. And it's what I refer to as regulation light. But I think we really need to have a discussion about reality and a discussion about what effective regulation is that could prevent the kinds of financial calamities that we've witnessed over the past 30 years. Everything from the S&L crisis through our current mortgage securitization financial crisis.
On that, you know, we had Alexis Goldstein occupy the SEC here, and we were talking about the Volcker rule and the failings of that rule. I think more came out on that just recently, really highlighting that failing.
What is the role of business in formulating the rule and their control through their lobbyists over the end result of that rule, and whether that rule will have teeth, or whether or not there'll be two great big exceptions to the rule, as we've seen in the case of the J.P. Morgan hedge fund bet, or hedge bet that went bad to the tune of $9 billion plus dollars.
In that case, I'm talking about the J.P. Morgan Chase London whale is what the name, the media's named it. But J.P. Morgan Chase said that it was a hedge. Because it was a hedge, they could use proprietary trading, which means trading with their own money and trading with the customer's money. Proprietary trading is generally banned by the Volcker Rule under the new Dodd-Frank legislation. Proprietary trading is generally banned, but in this case, because J.P. Morgan Chase says that it was hedging another bet, they would have been allowed to make this bet under the Volcker Rule.
That's a really interesting point. You were talking about customer segregated accounts. Would you talk about that a little bit more? Because that was pretty interesting, too.
In the past year, we've had two huge instances. It used to be that in hedge funds, there are accounts that when customers say, you know, I don't want the hedge fund playing around with my money. I'm going to take it off. I'm going to put it in the on the side. And that is a customer segregated account. There have been two instances. One of them was the MF Global scandal, where the firm was supposed to have more than $200 million in deposits for its customers, and it had only $5 million. Another one was Peregrine Financial Group. Normally, under regulation, hedge funds aren't supposed to touch that money, but all of a sudden, all of this money in these customer segregated accounts are gone. So either the owner stole it from the till, kind of, or they used it on bets, and we don't exactly know. And I actually got that wrong. Let me just correct myself. It was Peregrine Financial Group was supposed to have $200 million in its deposit for customers, and it only had $5 million. MF Global scandal went up to $1.6 billion. $1.6 billion of customer-segregated funds went missing. It's unbelievable, actually. And it just points to the fact that not only do we need regulation, we need good regulation, and we also need regulators who are watching.
It really goes to the heart of what the philosophy of regulating these entities is. And I think we have developed over the past 20 years this notion that the free market will regulate bad actors out of the market. That there's an assumption that's made that fraud and corruption in the service sector, in the financial service sector, are trivial problems. And that with more partnering with the industry, we can come up with a more effective regulatory environment without impeding on so-called innovation and risk-taking.
But again, even with the regulations, the banks are not following them. HSBC was found to be money laundering for terrorists, tax cheats, drug traffickers. They had connections with Iran, North Korea, Sudan, Burma, and Cuba. They were cited by the currency controller, OCC, in 2003, 2007, and again in 2010, but there were no fines imposed. There were no criminal prosecutions. I mean, if you or I accidentally gave money to a charity that gave money to a known terrorist organization, we would be put in jail. However, HSBC hasn't even been fined yet. I mean, talk about three strikes. The fines that they're talking about now are up to $1 billion, so there have been, you know, rumors of a fine. But it's not just HSBC is not alone. Credit Suisse, Lloyd's of London, Wachovia, American Express, Riggs Bank, and Barclays have already paid fines for failing to follow money laundering controls. And all the agreements that they had were deferred prosecutions, which mean that if they screw up again, maybe somebody will go to jail. But no criminal prosecution so far.
Well, I guess that's the, you know, that's part of the discussion, is what is effective regulation, what are effective sanctions. You know, I worked many years in the industry, and oftentimes the solution to an SEC charge was a settlement under which no one admitted any liability for any wrongdoing, and some fine was paid. And we've seen some eye-popping fines as of late, but it doesn't seem to change the culture of impunity. I would suggest that lack of criminal prosecution is one of the components we need to take a hard look at in terms of having effective regulation.
You know, that's part of what I'd like to go through today. What do we do? But also, how long has this been going on? Where does this begin? You know, I'd like to go back because we haven't we may have fought for what little regulation we've had, but we haven't always been this lax. This isn't something that just occurred, and I'd like to get to the root of it because I think that helps us understand.
I think it's this never-ending fight among it's these philosophies of, I guess, capitalism, where some think that we should leave the market to regulate itself, that 99% of the actors in any one of these sectors are good people with good ethics. We're talking about a few bad apples here and there, and that through cooperation, some kind of cooperative model, the government and industry can ferret out any of the defalcations that people engage in. I think that's fantasy. I think we've seen that demonstrated across industries, not just in the financial services sector. Effective regulation requires oversight, requires having examiners, requires rules with teeth, with real sanctions.
Criminal prosecution.
I think we go in and out. We have periods where, you know, after the Great Depression, we had Glass-Steagall. We had the 1930 and 1933 Securities and Exchange Act. We had the 1940 Investment Company Act. But then over time, industry was able to convince their supporters in the government that we didn't need that kind of regulation anymore. So we can get rid of Glass-Steagall. We could take down some of the regulatory framework that we've used over the past 60 years before the 90s. In any event.
We're going to take a short break, and I want you to ponder this question. Why are banksters not treated like gangsters? And on the other side of the break, we'll be talking with Professor Bill Black about it.
Taken, might as well be, and just leaves to rake. piled up in the trash can of fate, in the trash can of fate.
We're back. We are going to be talking with Professor Bill Black, a white-collar criminologist, former federal regulator, author of the book The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, and associate professor of law and economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Bill, this is Air Occupy. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
It's a privilege to have you on.
Nice to talk to you both.
I have to tell you, Dr. Black, I was reading your article, Reinventing Crony Capitalism, and after yodeling in my living room for a while, I read it to my husband, and it caused him to throw open the window and pull a Howard Beale. I can't take this anymore. It's just pretty incredible stuff. We were hoping maybe you would set the stage for us for how we got where we are, because nobody knows better than you.
Okay, so it's an odd paradox that in 1993, as the new administration, the Clinton administration, Clinton-Gore administration, comes into office, we have really succeeded in regulating in finance in two critical areas. One, we've contained this epidemic of fraud and that was growing at a massive rate. These were institutions growing at an average rate of 50% a year.
You're talking about the savings and loans.
Yeah, this is the savings and loan debacle, and they soon would have been well over $1 trillion loss to the country. And remarkably, a very conservative Reagan appointee, his name is Ed Gray, listened to the facts that the examiners were finding in the field. And they got it right from the beginning. And they said, this is fraud. And so he changed his approach entirely. He had been a big deregulator. And he re-regulated the industry, brought in the top supervisors in America, put them where the fraud was the worst, adopted regulations. He was detested by the Reagan administration. They threatened to bring a criminal referral against him because he was closing too many insolvent savings and loans. We even had that problem with regulators recently. You may have noticed type of thing. Right? And the Keating Five attacked him. A majority of the House of Representatives passed a resolution saying don't go forward. And in the face of all those things, he went forward with rules that killed all of these Ponzi schemes, and then he helped create the system that led to over 1,000 felony convictions in cases designated as major by the Justice Department.
Wow.
The agency made over 30,000 criminal referrals to do this, etc., right?
Wow.
So that was a big success. And then the second big success, except we didn't even think of it as, in that era, as a really big success, is that liar's loans began, as do all good frauds in America, in Orange County, California. And we were the regional regulators, and we said they weren't called liar's loans in that era, but they're loans made without verifying the borrower's income. And so the lenders engaged in fraud have a big incentive to inflate their income so that the loans can be made, and then they book fictional income and they get big bonuses, right? That's how modern executive compensation in conjunction with deregulation drives these frauds. So we said, this is crazy. These things have to end in disaster, and we just used normal supervisory means. We now were the regional regulators based in San Francisco and L.A., and we drove the liar's loans and the worst subprime loans completely out of the savings and loan industry, whereupon the worst of the entities, a place called Long Beach Savings, gave up its federal charter, gave up federal deposit insurance, and became a mortgage bank for the sole purpose of escaping our jurisdiction. And it changed its name to AmeriQuest, where it became the most notorious of the early fraudulent non-prime lenders. And then it was a three-time loser in terms of being sued by the government. And once they settled in what was then the biggest settlement for not only fraud but deliberately targeting minorities, so they were predatory plus fraudulent, they enter into this huge settlement with the state attorney generals, and promptly the head of the organization, Roland Arnau. Well, you won't, you know, here's the multiple choice. Was he A, indicted? B, was he thrown out of his clubs? Or C, did we make him ambassador to the Netherlands for the United States of America?
C.
Yeah, you got it. and of course, it was because he was the leading contributor to George Bush.
Which George Bush was that?
Oh, that's a good point. The second of the George Bushes. All right. So in 1993, this crackdown that I've just described by us was 1990-1991. And nobody even remembers that it happened, right? So liar's loans were driven out of the insured industry for a better part of a decade, but they started raging in the mortgage broker levels. Okay. What else happens around this time that the Clinton administration comes in? Well, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, hadn't received the Nobel yet, but everybody knew he was on the short list, George Akerlof and Paul Romer write an article, and they say, you know, the savings and loan regulators had it right. And they say, because we had no economic theory of fraud, economists were no help to the regulators. Now we know better. This is a direct quotation. If we learn the lessons, we need not have these crises reoccur. And the top criminologist, white-collar criminologist in America on financial fraud, reported the same thing, right? So you had the regulators, the criminologists, and the economists, and the National Commission appointed to investigate the causes of the savings loan debacle, which reported that at the typical large failure, fraud was invariably present. That's a direct quotation.
90%. Right?
So all of these things come together. And you would think the new administration would be all about, hey, here's the great success of government. You know, Ronald Reagan said government's the enemy. It's the problem. But here's where you have this great success. You saved $1 trillion. You brought the elites to justice. You showed that people were not above the law. Great. Wonderful. You'll be our model for reinventing government. And instead, of course, it was exactly the opposite. This is the Democratic Leadership Council, the conservative Republican wing of the Democratic Party. That came to power in Clinton and Gore, and they said Reagan, and they actually said Thatcher, Maggie Thatcher, were right. The government's the problem, regulation's the problem, private sector is the answer. And they, I actually personally witnessed this, they trained the banking regulators to treat the industry as the customer. That's the exact word that they used. And they insisted that the regulators reduce regulation, reduce enforcement, reduce prosecutions, and to work with the industry in doing all of this as their partner. And again, that was their word. Well, there's no better than no two words in the English language that would work better to destroy regulation than to tell the regulators that they should treat the banks as their customer and they should partner with them. So flash forward in time. Well, it turns out that the, as you say, the George W. Bush, then governor of Texas, was one of the big reinventing government people as well, which was, of course, Al Gore's thing, leading the Clinton initiative to reinvent government, by which he meant adopt Maggie Thatcher. So when Bush comes in, he appoints even more rabidly anti-regulatory heads, He picks Harvey Pitt to run the Securities and Exchange Commission because he's the leading opponent of regulation in America. And Pitt promptly goes to the accountants and says, I want to apologize for my agency for not always being a, quote, kinder and gentler regulator. Right? This is leading up to Enron era, which happens a few months after he gives the speech, that whole series of frauds and such. And in the savings and loan context, there was Chainsaw Gillerin, who is the very picture of a partnership with the industry. So your listeners can go online and find the 2003 annual report of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and they'll see this picture of Chainsaw Gillerin. He's holding a chainsaw. He's standing next to his customers, his partners, the three leading bank lobbyists in America. They're holding huge pruning shears, as is the guy who will be his successor as head of the Office of Thrift Supervision. And five of these folks are poised and posed around a pile of federal regulations.
That's
which is, by
chilling.
The way, the same motif that Clinton and Gore used, except they've now added, we're going to destroy regulation, and we're not going to be in the least bit careful about it. We're going to bring a chainsaw to the task. And in case it wasn't clear who the enemy was, the regulations were tied up in red tape to show that they were evil. And such. Well, they got exactly what they wanted, and the Office of Thrift Supervision became so weak that some of the frauds doing the liar's loans that you're most familiar with came back into the savings and loan industry doing these things. So Washington Mutual, Countrywide, IndyMac, all of these were savings and loans that were supposed to be regulated by the Office of Thrift Supervision. But if they're your customer and your partner, of course you don't regulate them. And then finally, to close the loop, why are there no prosecutions at all?
Good question.
Of any of the elites? Well, there are no criminal referrals. Same agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, that made over 30,000 criminal referrals in the savings and loan crisis, a crisis that was 1/70th the size of this crisis, and had fraud that was concomitantly smaller than this crisis. In the current crisis, the same agency made zero criminal referrals. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates the largest national banks, depending on which spokesperson you believe, made zero or three criminal referrals. The Federal Reserve, according to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, made three referrals for discrimination, two of which against foreign firms and one against some tiny U.S. entity. The FDIC was smart enough to refuse to answer the question. So, without criminal referrals, you don't get prosecution. So the only successful prosecution we have is Taylor Bean, which is an obscure but large mortgage banker that only the wonks of the wonks have ever heard about. And that prosecution only occurred because SIGTARP, the Special Inspector General of TARP, Mr. Borowski, Neil Borowski, whose new book, Bailout, I heartily recommend, he made the criminal referrals, not the banking regulators. This is a fraud that Fannie Mae discovered in 2001, think of that date, and refused to make a criminal referral against. And to wrap these things up, in September 2004, the FBI warns that there's an epidemic of mortgage fraud, their words, and predicts it will cause a financial crisis. In 2006, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the trade association of the PERPs, which, by the way, has formed a partnership with the FBI, in which they say, no, those aren't the droids we're looking for. Go look at the little people. Don't look at the banks. The banks couldn't commit fraud. Well, they reported that liars' loans were 90% fraudulent. Investigations have confirmed that it was the lenders who put the lies in the liars' loans and created the endemic appraisal fraud, which can only be done by lenders. And by the way, no honest lender would ever inflate an appraisal or make loans to people who can't repay the loans. And that's what happened. By 2006, there were over 2 million fraudulent liar's loans in that year alone. This is what hyperinflated the bubble and drove the financial crisis. So that's the shortest version of the story.
Wow.
Sounds like a perfect incubating laboratory for fraud.
See, that's what we call it. We call it a criminogenic environment, and that's a direct steal from medicine, where you talk about pathogenic environments. These are environments that create epidemics of crime or, of course, of disease.
No, you've written a lot.
We know what causes it, by the way. It's the three Ds: deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization that allow you to get away with it. And it's the change to modern executive and professional compensation where you are made rich by the fraud. As Akerlof and Romer, as I talked about the Nobel Prize winners that agreed with us, the title of their article says it all: looting the economic underworld of bankruptcy for profit. The CEO loots the organization. The organization is driven into bankruptcy, or in the modern era, bailed out by all of us. But the CEO walks away wealthy. And what Akerlof and Romer emphasized needs to be emphasized. They said, when you use this kind of accounting fraud mechanism, plus modern executive compensation, becoming wealthy is, and I quote, a sure thing.
This is a special rebroadcast of Occupy the Media's podcast. It's available at Podomatic, titled Air Occupy William Black on Why Haven't We Had a Perp Walk. That was Professor William Black. We'll go back to it now.
That quote actually, I think, stopped my breathing for a few minutes. I've got it underlined and some expletives next to it and a lot of explanation points. I'd like to read that quote again, just because it's so powerful. The title of their article says it all: looting the economic underworld of bankruptcy for profit. The market discipline, bankruptcy, is after years of fraud, enriched the CEO, then visited on the firm. The CEO, absent prosecution, walks away wealthy. I mean, does this sound familiar or what?
It is the crisis in a nutshell.
Does the control fraud that you write so much about, does that require this deregulated, desupervised environment, or is that a reaction to sort of endemic fraud?
It isn't a literal requirement, but effectively is. In other words, they'll move to the industry that's weakest.
They'll find the least regulated area.
That's right. Like water will find its level.
You were talking about short memory, and one of the things that you reminded me in that article of my own short memory was the savings and loan crisis, Whitewater.
Yes.
Under Clinton. You know, I'm reading this like, why on earth would, you know, how does an inspector general become the bad guy? I mean, they're the cops on the beat, as you refer to them. Just what we need, and they're just demoralized under Gore's the pat sayings. I mean, it was so simplistic when I'm reading it. The check mark cards, all regulators will. It was incredible to read this coming out of a report, presumably written by the vice president. These pithy sayings like a self-help guru.
Yeah, it was comic book deregulation.
Yeah.
It was, and again, you can understand it was the savings and loan stuff was a disaster for the Clinton administration. It, of course, begins the Whitewater investigation. The Clintons received this loan from a classic control fraud running the savings loan. Mrs. Clinton's law firm is the big firm representing a number of the worst frauds, and one of her partners is made the number two guy at the Justice Department, where he lies to investigators in his office and massively overbills the federal government. He just, you know, cheats all of us. So they wanted nothing to do with savings and loan prosecutions. So among the first things the Clinton administration did, I told you we got that 1,000 felony convictions. Well, we would have had well over 1,000, but they almost immediately they transferred a very large number of the FBI agents out of doing financial fraud and to healthcare instead, and they left the Bush. Now this is Bush 1 appointee, who was an acting head of the agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, in power for something like 5 years. And he was just a typical economist who didn't believe in regulation. Can you imagine leaving the, you know, Nixon's guy in charge for 5 years no. when you come in as a Democrat? It's just crazy stuff. But, of course, President Obama has done similar things. Geithner was a Republican. He became an independent as a complete fig leaf. And Bernanke, of course, is quite a partisan Republican. And President Obama promoted Geithner, a complete, absolute failure as a regulator, to be the Secretary of Treasury. And then President Obama reappointed Bernanke to run the Fed, even though Bernanke and Greenspan before him, after hearing these warnings from the FBI, after hearing that they were 90% fraudulent loans, refused to use their authority to ban the loans.
I can't tell you. That was what bothered me. It just drove me crazy. I couldn't understand how we were going to have no changes, no re-regulation, no consequences after the 2008. It just Geithner. It was just craziness.
Well, have you seen what Geithner just Borowski just said, that the phrase Geithner used, that he admitted to Borowski that the stuff that was supposedly help, you know, like HAMP, supposedly help for distressed borrowers, was really intended, quote, to foam the runway to protect the banks.
Protect the banks.
No,
yeah,
I didn't see that.
That just occurred, I think, some hours ago.
Interesting. So, what are we to make of sort of the crony capitalism and the revolving door that exists at the banking regulatory institutions, the securities institutions like the SEC and the CFTC? Is there a way to prevent that?
Well, you can. I mean, the Ed Gray story is a tale that gives one hope, right? That even in the Reagan administration, from a deeply conservative Republican, you could get somebody that would have one of these Road to Damascus conversions and come out as a swinging, vigorous regulator. And, you know, the system can't deal with people like that because they produce facts. And that's what drives the Geithners of the world crazy, that if you actually investigate, of course, you find LIBOR.
Right.
You find that all this stuff that the president and Geithner have been saying, and Holder, Attorney General Holder, have been saying, you know, downplaying any possibility of fraud. Well, of course, if you don't look for sophisticated frauds, you don't find them.
Right.
Duh.
Right.
You know? And so as long as they refused to look, there were no facts.
Yeah.
Now the CFTC actually started to look, and it found massive fraud. The Senate started to look, and it found massive fraud at HSBC, the largest bank in Europe. And I mean fraud everywhere in every context in the most despicable fashions possible. So these are areas that cannot stand an investigation. And it goes back to the old phrase from Brandeis that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so that's why they're desperately trying to keep these things opaque. And by the way, if you read the articles on Borofsky and the F-word filled rant attack by Geithner upon him, it's because Borofsky was pushing for transparency,
right,
for getting more facts out. So the bad news, of course, is that both parties, a leading campaign contributor is finance, and that under Citizens United, this is likely to get worse. The good news is that their positions are completely indefensible. And again, I would recommend Jamie Galbraith's book, about the predator state, about how the right has given up on anything, any pretense of free markets, and why the left needs to do so as well. There aren't free markets when you have crony capitalism. And even the right's economists often admit this now.
We hear about all the frauds and crimes that happened in 2008, 2009. What are the statute of limitations for this? Are the people in the administration and the banks, are they just waiting until they can no longer be brought up on charges?
Yes, is the short answer. And Borofsky, again, has commented on this. He said in, this is the New York Times with Gretchen Morgenson, that that's precisely what's about to happen, and that he didn't think there were going to be any serious prosecutions. The thing that may save politically the Obama administration is the LIBOR investigation. So there is speculation that there clearly been leaks from the Justice Department to both the New York Times and today to the Wall Street Journal. There are articles in which they claim that there are criminal investigations. The New York Times article leak said that they intended to indict. So this could be their perfect thing to have their token indictment.
You were involved with Occupy, is it Kansas City?
Oh, Kansas City and New York and L.A., yes.
Would you talk about that a little bit in this context?
Sure. So the Occupy New York asked me to come out, and I did this. And L.A., we had a teach-in. At KC, we have recurrent things that we do together. I'm also part of an effort that started here in Kansas City that we hope will become, you know, regional and eventually national. Jobs Now, with an emphasis on getting people employed. And we work very closely with Occupy. We have events about every 2 months. And I've been with them, you know, a speaker. Now a speaker is, you know, this was 25 seconds of, you know, sort of mic check as one of a number of folks talking when we had a local major corporation that was doing massive things in rate increases and such and trying to call on the regulators to take their job seriously. So we do lots of things on a recurrent basis, work together a lot.
Could you recommend one documentary to watch?
Yes. The best things, I think, frankly, are the Bill Moyers interviews. They're not documentaries formally, but they're very good. He's really a superb interviewer. I'm in other documentaries dealing with other nations' crises as well. So if people have interest in Iceland or, you know, the flash crash and such, I mean, I have some roles in those and some coming out in France and such. In the United States, it's probably still, Michael Moore's. You can call it a documentary or you can call it not a documentary, but whatever it is, it is. But I appear more extensively in that.
Now, you say...
Capitalism, a love story.
Oh, yes. We showed it recently. You said that LIBOR, these investigations are kind of, it sounds like, probably more for show. We're talking about really entrenched criminality here, I guess, you know. Where do we go? What do
we
do?
Well, I'm not sure that they will end up primarily for show. I mean, you have to give... again, as bad as the things I've been describing are, the United States is massively better than the rest of the world on these things. So in the United Kingdom, they actively resisted giving the Commodities Future Trading Commission access to the documents at Barclays that broke this thing open. And the CFTC, and again in credit, it began this investigation under the Bush administration, persisted for years and got the documents, and they, you know, these things then take on a life of their own. As I said, you create facts, and the facts have a dynamic of their own. So this is a really big deal in the United Kingdom. Americans don't generally understand this. But this is the cause celeb, the political scandal, and it's going to get massively worse because at least six banks are going to plead and cut deals on all of this. And they're going to have to release other documents as well. And again, I really hope your listeners will actually look at a number of these emails, because what you're going to see is that white-collar crooks sound a whole lot like blue-collar crooks. What's wonderful at Barclays is there is no pretense that integrity plays any role. There is no pretense that they wouldn't jump at the chance to violate the law to make a buck. There is no pretense that they're really competitors. They work with the other banks against the public. All of these things are absolutely clear on the face of the documents. And when people read these things, they will never think of, well, you know, who believe in banks, they will never be able to think of banks in the same way again.
It's just shocking. Some of the emails are just shocking.
No, they're not shocking at all. Absolutely what we expected.
That actually highlights something else that was in your article that I'd like to touch on briefly, which is the Gresham principle.
Yes, Gresham's dynamic.
Yes. Would you talk about that for just a minute?
Sure. Gresham's law deals with hyperinflation, and it says that bad money drives good money out of circulation. And back to George Akerlof, his most famous article was back in 1970, and it was about a different kind of fraud, a fraud in which the seller of goods cheats us about the quality. And he talked about the market for lemons. Lemons, of course, is what we call a bad car, a really, really bad car, where the seller knows it's a crappy car, but lies to us about its quality, right? And Akerlof made the point, he said there's a metaphor to Gresham's law, and that is the seller of crappy cars can, of course, buy them really cheap and then resell them to us for a lot of money. And Akerlof's point was an honest competitor can't compete because they have to pay a lot more money to buy a good car, and then they resell it as a used car. And so you said bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace. And market forces become perverse in those circumstances. Well, that's really powerful. And by the way, two centuries before he said it, Jonathan Swift said it in Gulliver's Travels.
Oh, the irony.
It's the Lilliputians, he says, have this rule that fraud is far worse than usual theft. Because usual theft, you know, with reasonable precautions, we can protect ourselves against. But you can't protect yourself very well against deceit. And when it happens, honest people can't compete with it. So this is something that you know, we've known about for a very, very long time. Well, that means that markets left to their own self will become disastrous if fraud occurs in them. And of course, fraud will tend to occur into them for precisely those reasons. So instead of being the enemy of effective markets, regulators who prevent cheaters from prospering are the only thing that can save markets and make them effective and fair. And you have to be the regulatory cops on the beat. So here's the key thing that people don't understand, although occupiers tend to. We have a million people, roughly, in America in our criminal law enforcement. Roughly all but 2,500 of them do blue-collar crimes or non-crimes, like Occupy, like arresting occupiers, right? We have roughly 2,300 industries in the United States. So we have about one FBI agent that does white-collar fraud investigations per industry.
Wow.
So a couple of things. One, they obviously don't have expertise in the industries.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is they obviously don't walk a beat. So they are in their office until they get a criminal referral. Well, here's the next thing. Do you think a bank makes a criminal referral on its CEO?
Not likely.
Not likely, right? Well, you understand that. You understood it instantly. We can't get the prosecutors to understand that in the modern era. It's a hilarious, sad thing simultaneously. So only the regulators are going to make the criminal referrals, or at least large numbers of the criminal referrals. You may have episodic whistleblowers, right? But overwhelmingly, that's how you got the 30,000-plus criminal referrals from our agency. That doesn't happen. And so we are not serving as the cops on the beat. And so bad ethics has driven good ethics out of the marketplace. And that's what you saw with LIBOR, that the largest banks in the world were all frauds. That's what you saw at HSBC. That's what you saw when you had 90% of liars' loans fraudulent, over 2 million a year. You don't get episodic fraud. You get epidemics of fraud. And for the reasons we talked about earlier, they tend to concentrate in the areas that are most criminogenic, which is where these 3Ds have gotten most out of control, and compensation for executives and professionals has gotten most out of control. And here's another key thing on the Gresham's dynamic. The lenders can deliberately create a Gresham's dynamic. So in the case of appraisers, you don't bribe appraisers. I mean, some people do, but that's really clumsy. Like, that's like the D-minus student in fraud. All you do is you first leak to them what the sales price is of the home and loan amount. And then if they inflate the appraisal so it's big enough to permit the loan, you send them future business.
Self-perpetuating.
If they don't, you don't send them the business. You never even have to have a discussion.
It's been really a privilege having you on today. We'd really like to have you back at some point because we think we need to spend more hours on this and talk about a new regulatory framework.
Well, I want to thank you and all of your listeners and urge folks to keep up the fight. The savings and loan debacle, as I say, does offer hope as well as fear.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, this has been Air Occupy.
Peace.
Higher education, and two of them are searching for lost souls. But the driver never ever saw a stop sign, and 18-wheelers, you know, they can't stop on a dime. But there are three wooden crosses on the right side of the highway. Why there's not four of them, heaven only knows. I guess it's not what you take when you leave this world behind you. It's what you leave behind you when you go. And that far And that teacher left her wisdom in the minds of all the children in hopes of giving them a better start. And that preacher whispered, "Can't you see the promised land?" as he laid that Bible in that hooker's hand. And there are three wooden crosses on the right side of the highway. Why there's not four of them, heaven only knows. I guess it's not what you take when you leave this world behind you. It's what you leave behind you when you go. That's the story that my preacher told last Sunday as he held that bloodstained Bible up for all of us to see. He said, "Bless that farmer and that teacher and that preacher who gave this Bible to my mama who read it to me." And there are three wooden crosses on the right side of the highway. Why there's not four of them? Well, now I guess we know. I guess it's not what you take when you leave this world behind you. It's what you leave behind you when you go. There are three wooden crosses on the right side of the highway. Why there's not four of them? Now I guess we know. I guess it's not what you take when you leave this world behind you. It's what you leave behind you when you go. When you go. There are three wooden crosses on the right side of the highway. Why there's not four of them? Now I guess we know. Guess it's not what you take when you leave this world behind you. Is what you leave behind you when you go, when you go.
Thanks for listening. I'm Jimmy Tardy. This has been Occupy Radio, a special rebroadcast of Occupy the Media's podcast, which you can find on Podomatic. That's Podomatic.com. Titled Air Occupy, William Black on Why Haven't We Had a Perp Walk. Tonight's show included music from our friend Lullaby and also Lullaby doing a tune by Randy Travis called Three Wooden Crosses. Now remember,
Occupy, Occupy.
The time is 7:03. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Hard Knock Radio is next.
Last year, the Oregon legislature passed a bill to reduce the size and cost of our state prison system. The bill flatlined prison growth, reduced sentences, and extended transitional leave. The money saved from these reforms was reinvested in Oregon counties for programs and services to help reduce prison intakes, protect the public, and lower recidivism. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear how Washington County plans to spend its justice reinvestment funds. That's Prison Pipeline, March 24th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.FM under Community Events.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
In this country.
What's up, fam? You're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. On today's program, the new documentary that examines the story of Lavelle Mixon. And then later on in the program, author Professor Pinnell Joseph on the legacy, the life of Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael. All this and more ahead, but first, these news headlines.
This is M1 from Dead Prez.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Real radio. From the concrete up. All the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all. One love.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned. David.